Gordon Thackeray won. Where were you born, please?
In Valletta, in Malta.
Which year was this?
1923.
What did your father do for a living?
My original father was a soldier, but him my mother divorced, and my stepfather was in the Navy, Royal Navy. So, in fact, my stepfather, my adopted father, he adopted me, was in the Royal Navy.
So you don't have any Maltese background, really?
No. He was a serviceman.
Did you go to school in Malta or in
England? No, we came back to England when I was about 9 months old.
So where were you educated?
In Devonport at Plymouth.
How old were you when you left school?
14 and a half.
So we're talking about the late 30s?
Yes, 38.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I entered the examination to Devonport Dockyard, and I did 2.5 years as a boilermaker apprentice.
Were you doing that job when war broke out?
I went in September of 1938. War broke out in September of 1939. But I was only in September of 1939, as you can work out, I was only just 16. Well, in fact, I was only 15 and a half, because my birthday is in November. So, in fact, I was under 16 at the time, so I couldn't do anything about it at the time. And then in April of 1941, my father was killed at sea. He was part of a gun crew on an armed liner called the Red Rutana. And the ship was torpedoed just off Iceland. And they took to the lifeboats, and the U-boat came to the service and machine gun the lifeboats. And he was buried. He was wounded before then, but after that, that killed him. And he was buried in Reykjavik, in Iceland. That's my father, sorry. My stepfather, as it is.
What happened to you in the first year of the war?
Well, I was, as I said, I was working in Devonport Dockyard as an apprentice, boilermaker apprentice, and I stayed there. And when I was 17 and three quarters, which was September of 40, where am I now, 42. When I was 17 and three quarters, the only way I could get out of the apprenticeship was because there was a reserved occupation and you couldn't leave it. I was had signed on as an apprentice, so I couldn't leave it. And the only way I could get out of it was to join the Royal Air Force as a trainee pilot or navigator. And I volunteered for that as soon as I was old enough, September 1942.
Why were you so keen to get out of the reserved occupation?
Well, I didn't want to stay there. I didn't like Devonport Dockyard or the people who were in it, because you only had to have an aeroplane flying within 10 miles of the place, and the whole workforce disappeared down the shelter, and that didn't do me. Plus the fact that I didn't like the idea of my father being killed by being machine gunned by a U-boat commander. So I decided to do something about that. So I joined the Air Force, and trained as a pilot for about 6 months, and failed my navigation because it's quite difficult mathematically. And as I said, I left school when I was under 15, so I wasn't very bright. So I came out of the Air Force and joined the Army later, about 6 months, 5 months later.
If I could just stop you there and go back to Devonport Dockyard.
Yes.
Why do you think the workforce had that attitude?
Well, I was on. I was working 7 days a week at that time. A second-year apprentice is allowed to work overtime. I was working 7 days a week, a fortnight on days, then a fortnight on nights, with the middle Sunday off sort of thing. So I got to know the whole of the workforce. And this was in 41 during the air raids. But you only needed one reconnaissance aircraft to pass over the top from 10,000, 12,000, 15,000 feet. And all the workforce would rush away down to the air raid shelters. I used to stand there and look at them and think to myself, oh my God, what a way to live. Spend the whole of the war just doing that. I don't know why. Maybe because they're all older men, so I think the only young people were the apprentices and the work boys. All the labouring youngsters had disappeared off to the Navy at that time, Navy and Army sort of thing. So it left a lot of older men in the working in the yard, and they tended to be more cautious, shall I say. This is my opinion.
Did they seem to be really scared?
I can show you that when on nights, invariably at 10 o'clock at night, you get a plane over. I can assure you that they really ran for the shelter. And this could be just one plane. Just one plane, and they really ran for the shelter. This is my opinion. No, I might be wrong. I might be saying this. I used to stand on one side and look at them running for the shelter. I was invariably the last one in, so I think not because I was particularly brave, but because I didn't want to be scared.
Well, they must have known it was just the regular recce plane.
The sirens went, you see, so that was it. The sirens would go when a recce plane came over because the sirens operators would not know that that was in fact a recce plane and not a bombing plane. So I assumed they just sounded the sirens anyway. And that was the siren for them to disappear off down to the shelters very sharply. And I can assure you, they ran. They really ran. And there was no gunfire, no nothing. Just one aeroplane in the sky and the sirens would go rush to the shelters.
Were they trembling with fear?
No, not necessarily. I think they were just pleased to get down there. As soon as they got down there, the cars came out and that was it.
Was it men or women in the workforce?
During the day, women worked during the day, but they didn't. There were very few of them working at night, only in particular jobs. And the women were not particularly. They were younger women, and they tended to be a bit calmer about it, shall I say. The younger women. They were a bit calmer, but they made their way to the shelters when necessary. But it was mainly at night, you see. The raids were mainly at night. During the day, it was very little in the way of raids.
Did any bombs fall near you in Devonport?
Yes, we were bombed at my home. We were bombed out three times.
Can you describe what happened?
We lived at. I lived with my mother at the time. My father had been, as I said, my father had been killed. My stepfather had been killed, so I lived with my mother, and we had a basement flat, as we'd call it now, two rooms, and an outside lavatory. And I lived with her, and we lived in a house that, funny enough, was built from granite rocks made from the old Edison lighthouse. Very unusual. When it had been demolished, they brought the bricks back, the rocks, the granite rocks back, and built houses from them, which I suppose helped. But anyway, it didn't make any difference. It was still bombed. We were still bombed. Then we moved across to a friend's place and stayed with them, and then they were bombed again about a week later. And then we moved to another house, which was partly demolished. Again, when I say moved to a house, we're talking about small flats, because there was only my mother and me, and she was only living on a pension. And my pay at the time was 17 shillings and sixpence. That was the basic pay. The old money, of course. It wasn't much, but it was enough. I gave her quite a bit, most of it. And we moved again to a third place, where the house was partly demolished, the top part was damaged badly. But after that, we weren't bombed out again.
Do you remember the addresses of any of these three houses?
Oh, dear, now you got me. First two were in St. Albans Street, which is a hill that stretched. The main damage to Devonport, which is the end where I lived, was done to the main street and the dockyard itself. Main Street was called 4 Street. And St. Albans Street was a hill that stretched down from 4th Street, and 4th Street was entirely demolished, completely demolished from end to end. And the top part of St. Albans Street was demolished as well, which is included my house, or the flat we lived in, and the friend's house, which was directly opposite. So we got caught both times. The third place we lived in was Chapel, Street, which is the next street over. But we lived there at the bottom of the street, which is another hill which led away from 4th Street. But we lived there at the bottom, so that was another 300 or 400 yards further away, which probably explains why the house was only damaged as opposed to being destroyed.
And you said this was 1941, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
So were you bombed out three times close together in time?
Yes, yes, yes. As I say, first time was, I can't remember the exact month, but it was fairly early, I should say, April, May time, during the worst part of the bombing, because, as you know, Plymouth was badly damaged by a serious bombing quite early in 41. And the second time was within a very short period, a week or 10 days. And the third time was all, we'd settled down a bit, and this was probably about a month or 6 weeks afterwards. Yes, it was about it, roughly, I can't remember the exact dates, but that was it, roughly.
Did it make you hate the Germans?
Not that, no. I mean, it was impersonal, sort of. I disliked them anyway. Yes, I hated them for what they did to my father. So you can't add to that. It's just one of those things.
How do you think public morale stood up to the bombing?
Very good indeed. I in fact was, as I say, 4th Street took the worst of the damage during the bad period, which was, I think, about April 41. And I think I was probably the last one to walk down through 4th Street because I lived with my girlfriend. Not lived, I beg your pardon. I had a girlfriend on the other side of Devonport Park, which is a quite big park in between 4th Street and other parts of the town. St. Budo, she lived, and I used to see her every evening. And when the bombing started, I'd take her home and then walk back. So I was probably one of the last people who walked down through 4th Street, and it was a massive flame on either side, on both sides. And I walked down the middle sort of thing, and to myself, it was a shame because there were some lovely old buildings there.
Was there much opposition from the dockyard to your trying to get out to
work? To join the Air Force?
Join the Air Force?
Suggestion that I shouldn't, not of opposition as such. They suggested it was probably better to finish my apprenticeship and join the Navy if I wanted to join up. But I said I didn't want to, I wanted to get away sort of thing. And after that initial suggestion, they didn't worry because it was quite a large workforce there. And I was only an apprentice anyway. So.
What type of work were you doing in the dockyard?
I was a boilermaker apprentice. So actually building and repairing boilers. That was our game. This is days of steam boilers, of course, and a lot of riveting and welding and that sort of thing went on. And that's mainly our main part of it. My main part of it was I spent about a year on a thing called a drawing board, which is a large area, probably stretched from about here up to that top corner in length. Of very flat wood, and which, when a plan came in, we'd lay out a drawing on this floor, on this wooden floor, of the pipes and the cylinders and everything else that was part of that plan, so that the boilermaker could come along and measure. You know, they'd bring a pipe along and lay it out on the floor, say right there and there, that would be the length of that particular pipe, and then they'd cut it off and start from there. This saved them having to measure the distance between the actual boilers. There are three boilers, of course, involved. I shouldn't say, of course, I beg your pardon. There are three boilers involved, one in each corner with a triangular effect, another one at the top. Now, these were steam boilers, and they were connected with tubes, boiler tubes, which is zinc-plated iron. And, there must have been... Well, depending on the size of the boiler, of course, it must have been 200 or 300. And obviously, since they went round the surface of the boilers themselves, they varied, every roll varied in length, because the three boilers were round, and the length of the each length of tube varied in length, and we dealt with that by laying the plan of the boilers out on this flat wooden surface, and the boiler makers would come along and say, right, the outside length is that long, because they were able to put the tube down or measure it, whichever they wanted to do, and say, right, that's the outside length, and they would then cut their tubes long enough for them to go along the outside length of the row, so the long row on the outside length of the boiler. And the inside length would be that much long again, but the one on the centre length would be the shortest one of the lot. And as we did, we laid out, as I said, we did that for about a year. We had the shop roof blown off, but me and another apprentice mended that. We brought in a lot of corrugated iron, and we rigged up pulleys and went up on the roof and mended that so the drain wouldn't go on the floor, the wooden floor. And we just carried on from there. So.
How did you feel about failing to get into Acro?
I was very disappointed. I saw the commanding officer and asked for another chance, but he refused. And since I failed on navigation, I couldn't transfer to being a navigator, since I'd failed navigation. I then volunteered to be an air gunner, but they said I couldn't be an air gunner because that was not included in the list of professions to be followed that I volunteered for to get out of being working in the dockyard. So the only choice was pilot or navigator. And since I couldn't be an air gunner, I had to come out, so I think.
And then you said you got into the army. And
well, yes, so I didn't go back to the dockyard, of course. Officially, I should have done, but I didn't, and that was it. And I went to work. I was working in Civil Street for a short while, for 5 months, I think. Went working on airfields up in the Midlands, digging them and working with Irish Navies and that sort of thing, living in London and that sort of thing. And did that, as I say, for a short period, but that wasn't very satisfactory. It was, it was just an interim job. And then the early part of, what year am I now, 43, early part of 43, I volunteered for the Air Force, for the Army, I beg your pardon, for the Army. And was allocated to the tank corps, to tank regiments, I think. And I did initial training at Beverley, and then moved to the 54th Training Regiment at Barnet Castle.
Beverley in Yorkshire?
Beverley in Yorkshire, yes. That's where we did most people did their initial 3 weeks training, just getting kitted out and doing the basic footwork and that sort of thing. And I moved up to Barnet Castle in Yorkshire, up near Catterick, Richmond that way. And went to the 54th Training Regiment, where I trained as a operator driver. Mainly, first trade as radio operator, and second trade as a driver.
What type of tanks did you learn to drive?
Sherman.
Were they easy to drive?
Oh, they're very easy to drive, as long as you've got good shoulders. They work on a tiller bar principle. You hoist back the tiller bar and then go left and hoist back the left tiller bar to go right. And just change gear and go forward. So they're very easy to drive.
Did you go into action with the tank corps?
No, I didn't. Actually, in fact, didn't leave the tank regiment because the Jebras came around and asked for volunteers whilst I was still in the training regiment. That would be about May 43. May, June time, 43, came round and asked for volunteers. And I volunteered for that. And carried on training for a short while, but in the meantime, the Jebras Special Forces, so then called me to them and we went off to tests.
What did they tell you about it to induce you to volunteer?
At that stage, nothing. They didn't go into details of the job at all. They merely said it was a special job and wanted volunteers. And I felt that, reading the writing on the wall, I felt that being with the tank regiment would eventually lead to some sort of action, but I didn't really think I'd stand much chance of any action for some while anyway, because in my opinion D-Day wasn't going to come. I could have gone out to the Far East or something like that at that stage, but there was no indication that I would do. So I thought to myself, well, this might be a better chance of seeing some action.
Why were you so keen to get into action?
Well, I still hadn't satisfied my original grudge against the Germans for killing my father.
Was it easy to get accepted for the Jedburgh team?
No, it wasn't. If you read the history, you'll see that something like 80 volunteered as radio operators, mostly tank corps. There were about three infantrymen and one signals or something like that. All the rest were tank corps of some sort. And mainly because they were used to working as crews, small groups. This was their reasoning. They were used to working as crews in small groups. And mainly because, and also because they took operators so that they had the basic operating skills necessary to transmit and receive messages and to operate and repair the sets. This is one of the things they had in mind. And that's what they had in mind. We, of the 80 odd that volunteered originally, it reduced eventually to 45. So that was during training, before they told us, gave us any indication of what the job was going to be. So some, whatever it is, 35 went off back to their units without knowing what the job was.
What was the next thing that happened to you?
Well, we went down to, as I say, we went down to Henley. We went to Oxford, Starford, for a test, the initial test. That was psychological tests and test of operating ability, radio operating ability, and medical examinations. Although they didn't case us round at that stage, they just wanted to see who we were and what we were. So having passed that, we went to Henley-on-Thames, Charlotte Gardens, I think it was called.
Don't worry too much about looking at
it. Charlotte Garden, where we lived in Nissen Hut, and we marched every morning, or chase marched every morning up to a place called Fawley Court, which was, we thought of it as a special training school, but in fact it was a radio station operating to operators already in the field. That was Fawley Court, where we did radio training and physical training, and things like shooting, literally. The officers in turn did their training without the radio side of it, on explosives and that sort of thing, and planning and that sort of planning operation of the groups they were expected to get into. But even they weren't told exactly what they were going to do. I think they had a better idea than we did, but they kept quiet about it. In fact, our training was entirely separate, really. Fawley Court was mainly for the operators, and the officers did most of their training up in the Midlands and that sort of thing. This went on for quite some while until they opened up Milton Hall in early 44. Yes, early 44. January, something like that. Milton Hall being near Peterborough. That, when they opened that up finally, they got us all together. Now, when we first met our officers and sorted out who we were going to go into battle with, something. Or go into action with battle. It was probably a bit dramatic.
How did you team up?
Well, we met all the officers, and we sort of, the officers initiated the meetings. I think they went to their commanding officer, our commanding officer, and he sort of went through the papers and said, well, this chap is so-and-so, he's a good operator, he's a bit of a bullshit man. I said, well, that sort of thing, you know, I mean, sorry. That sort of thing, would not necessarily those words, but I mean, that sort of, they went to the officer, the commanding officer, and said, look, I'd like a chap who's so-and-so, a good operator, but he's got to be fit and all the rest of it. And the commanding officer would sort out three or four names, and the officers would arrange to meet us for a beer or something like that, and we'd go quietly in the corner somewhere. And if they liked us, then they asked us to be their operator. And if we liked them, we said yes.
And you had the rank of sergeant, did you?
We had the rank of sergeant. We were made lance sergeants. The trouble was all the Americans were sergeants, you see. We were all privates. They were all Americans were sergeants. The French, in fact, were all officers. I'm talking about operators now. So they considered at one time, Americans all officers, which they considered a bit too silly for words. So in order to be the same as the Americans, they made us all lance sergeants, which was, of course, as you know, a corporal, unpaid sergeant. And we then stayed as unpaid corporals, unpaid sergeants, after three stripes on, no pay, until we did the jumps, which was in February, March, 44. We went to Ringway near Manchester Airport, or on Manchester Airport, and did our practice jumps. And that was the day jumps. And the night jump, I did a one night jump, and we did that on the common near Peterborough.
Any incidents that happened to you during the training?
No, not really. No, it was it was hard. The training, the physical side of it was quite hard. We were trained by PTIs who'd warrant officers who had no pity at all and chased us around. And we used to get up, dragged out of bed about 6 every morning and dual route march, a forced march or anything, and then back for breakfast, and then forced march up again to out to training. And then majority of the day we spent on radio training.
How good an operator were you? How fast were you?
I did 23s when I was on top form, 23 words each way. 23 words a minute, which was very good. I could have gone anywhere with that. I mean, the very Marconi people, you can go up to about 28, something like that. But this is just an ordinary key, not the side key, of course. The side key, you could do much better.